Good evening, everyone. I hope you're doing well. I'm Reinhard Wolf, and you're listening to Red Ice Radio. The show is normally hosted by Henrik Palmgren, who's currently finishing up our brand new members' website, so be on the lookout for that. Our guest for today is Millennial Matt. Matt is a free speech activist who is perhaps best known for trolling Shia LaBeouf at He Will Not Divide Us in New York. So without further ado, let's jump right in. Matt, welcome to Red Ice. How are you doing today?
I'm doing well. How are you?
Doing well, thank you. So before we get into some of the main topics of the show here, why don't we have you tell us a little bit about yourself, your background, and so forth.
So I guess my background, I grew up in Maine, in a little town on the northern border of Maine, and I moved down to Worcester, Massachusetts in my younger years and grew up there for the most part, and had a pretty normal childhood, I guess. I went to art school and dropped out and worked some odd jobs here and there to sort of float by. And
okay, so people who know you essentially for making, you have a YouTube channel, you're on Twitter, you've done some pretty hilarious trolling of various famous people. So how did you get red pilled?
My red pill sort of journey has been a long one, like most people, I assume. I guess it started with art school, really. I went to art school and I wanted to be like a film producer. And when I was at art school, I didn't get along with anybody. And I sort of felt like I was the only person that had a real life before art school. Like, if you can imagine every art kid from your high school in the same room, like in every high school, just in the same building, it's really a strange climate. And there's like a lot of competition. And so I dropped out of art school, and that kind of was the beginning of the whole like red killing experience. After art school, I started working for international charities, and feeding the children in the third world, and I even worked for like this third party charity that raised money for Planned Parenthood, actually, and I was like a complete leftist at that point, and I started like being exposed to like the other side of the field, people started like showing me like Margaret Sanger quotes and stuff, like, what she said about, black people on various occasions and so I started looking at all of that a little bit differently. And, I guess like the one moment that like really sort of opened my eyes to what was going on, I was dragged to one of the first Black Lives Matter protests in Boston. And there's about 10,000 people in the streets. And so like all my coworkers, we were all, SJW leftists or whatever. And, we all went together as a group. And, at one point during the rally, this group of people walked up to me. Most of them were black, and one of them was not, but they walked up to me and they shoved a camera in my face and were like, "Get to the front of the line, white boy." And I instantly, told them like, "Don't fucking talk to me like that," this one kid with a camera, he like shoved the camera like right in my face, and he started calling me racist, started like yelling at me, and so I literally like shoved him away from me, and then I put my fist up to defend myself because these people were like, they were getting violent with me, and I basically challenged them. I was like, either back off or you'll be sorry. And so it was this big moment in my life when I sort of realized, like, I have no idea what the hell I'm doing here. I don't know what these people are doing here. And it was just really confusing altogether. So that was sort of like the beginning of my like descent into this whole world, really.
Yeah, I would imagine being, you know, personally involved on the ground with Black Lives Matter is enough to red pill most people. You know, in fact, I think most people who are red-pilled today, or at least a substantial amount, ended up getting red-pilled, you know, by Black Lives Matter, but on the internet, just by watching the riots and the protests after, you know, Mike Brown and Trayvon were killed, and their killers, you know, got off scot-free in court. But yeah, you were perhaps a little more intimately involved, and you saw a side of it that, you know, the average shitlord on poll didn't get to see.
Right, yeah.
So people generally know you for your YouTube videos, for some of your trolling instances. So why don't you tell us, I think this is probably your best-known one. You were at Shia LaBeouf's He Will Not Divide Us event in New York, and you were able to troll him pretty well. So why don't you tell us a little bit about kind of your experiences at He Will Not Divide Us and in the trolling of Shia LaBeouf.
Okay. Yeah, that's sort of where I made my like entrance onto the scene. And I had been trolling people in general a long time before Shia LaBeouf and all of that. Like, for instance, like, real quickly, one of, like, the most, like, well-known, like, trolling moments of my life before the whole He Will Not Divide Us thing was there was this movie being filmed in a town close to where I grew up called Grown Ups. And I ended up sneaking onto the movie set. And sure enough, one of, like, the coordinators there, he grabbed me and he ended up, he thought I was actually there to work. So they put me right next to Chris Rock and, they were like, oh yeah, you know, we're going to film a scene. So pretend you're friends and this and that. And, so I was like in all these movie scenes with like Chris Rock and Kevin James and David Spade and Rob Schneider.
And, wow. I had no idea. That's amazing.
Yeah. And then, so like at the end of the day, the same guy, he walked up to me and he was like, who the hell are you? Did we dress you, you know? And I was like, oh no, man, I just sort of dropped by. And so I ended up having to, they ended up having to pay me, because if they didn't pay me, then they would have had to refilm all of those scenes. So, if you watch that movie, Grown Ups, you, can look for me in the funeral home scene. But, I saw He Will Not Divide Us. He Will Not Divide Us was like this, basically the protest of Donald Trump, of a 4-year protest to basically protest Donald Trump. I don't even know like how to explain it from their point of view. But you basically stand in front of the camera and you chant, "He will not divide us, he will not divide us," over and over and over again. And that kind of speaks to like the essence of the left in general is we don't see them engaging in like meaningful dialogue. All we really ever see of them is violence and 5-word mantras. Whether it's Black Lives Matter, whether it's Antifa, all we ever see of these people is just mindless chanting, and they don't even know why they're out there. You put a camera in their face and they can't even explain to you what they believe. So this was sort of just like a microcosm of the greater political, social, you know, fabric of our society at the moment. So I saw this basically as an opportunity to troll the hell out of the left, but also, get my voice heard, you know, much more so than it could otherwise have been heard on YouTube alone or something like that. So, I drove down to He Will Not Divide Us. It took me like about 4 hours to get there. And, I basically just started talking about revisionism, right off the bat. And that really ticked everybody off. And yeah, and then so coincidentally, I ended up finding Shia LaBeouf, and I told him that Hitler did nothing wrong, and he assaulted me. And then there were all these news articles about it, like the Daily Mail called me a Nazi and this and that. And but yeah, I mean, I wasn't the first or the last person that Shia LaBeouf would be assaulting during the He Will Not Divide Us fiasco.
Or in general, yeah.
Or in general, yeah.
Seems to be a recurring theme with him.
Yeah, it's a recurring theme with the left. So yeah, that's you know, basically how that all went down. I knew that I had an opportunity to say anything I want. And so I decided that the most powerful message, the most triggering message, you know, would be like basically revisionist history. So
yeah, well, it seems like you got the reaction you were looking for. He didn't like that at all. So in the video, you're pretty much, it looks like you're taking a selfie with him. And I think you say something, you guys are just banter for a few seconds and then you say it. And then you can see him hit you and he starts walking off into the street. So what kind of, I mean, did anything happen after that? Were people standing around? Were they pretty upset? Did they hear it?
No, only like one kid was like, "Hey man, like, why are you messing with Shia LaBeouf?" And, you know, and I was just kind of standing there, as Shia LaBeouf walked away, and I was just trying to get him to like talk to me. And, unfortunately I didn't get the rest of that interaction on camera, but he was just yelling at me like just, I couldn't even recognize what he was saying. He was just calling me a bigot. He's like, "You fucking bigot." Like in this like drunken, sloppy manner. And,
He has this really like forced tough guy demeanor about him. It doesn't come off as, you know, as if he's actually a tough guy. It's him like just being kind of a sad human being and trying to like be tough about it, I guess.
Yeah. And that's part of the reason why like I like didn't press charges or like didn't really get angry with him. You know, because at the end of the day, like he seems to be playing a part. And he seems to be like extremely confused. And like the way I see him is he is more of a victim of our society than you or I, because he grew up closer to the issues. Like he's a Hollywood child actor. Like you and I could never, you know, fathom what he might have had to go.
I'm sure.
You know what I mean? So like at the end of the day, like I really do feel for him. And I hope, you know, if he ever hears this, and I've said it multiple times, but, you know, I just, you know, I hope he's doing all right, and I don't hate him or anything. I honestly feel for him.
Yeah, that's kind of in my perspective on him, too. I mean, you can tell that he has some issues, and, you know, who knows where those issues came from. The fact that he was a childhood, you know, a child actor in... you know, modern day Hollywood really opens, you know, the possibilities for why he's kind of screwed up are endless there. You know, I read something that his dad, like, sexually assaulted some underage girl. It was on the set of Even Stevens, I believe. So, yeah, I mean, who knows what went on behind the scenes there. It's just, you know, peak degeneracy for various reasons. But okay, so you've got a YouTube channel too, where obviously you've uploaded the trolling videos. So I was kind of looking through it the other night, and one of them I found particularly funny, and a little depressing at the same time, was the black trans legal advice. So why don't you kind of walk us through what happens in that video and what kind of led you to do something like that?
So, anybody listening hasn't seen the video, it's this character that I've been building, where I pretend that I am formerly a white male and am transitioning into becoming a black female. And I use this character on a lot of people, and these guys just so happen to have a show where they give legal advice. So I changed the story a little bit to sort of fit my subject matter, but I call these guys up and I give them my background story. You know, like, oh, you know, I'm
dyeing my skin every day. I'm taking hormones. I'm going through speech therapy lessons so I sound like a black female. And then, you know, I'll follow that up with, like a request for, you know, some advice or whatever. You know, like I call this one guy who gave toolbox advice. He was like some hillbilly. So you can use the same character on any of these people. But what I do here is I put these people in a hard place because the left demands that you treat these people, these, you know, transitioning individuals, fairly and with almost more respect than anybody you would normally treat. So these guys, they basically tiptoe around the whole thing, and they tell me to go to Thailand. They tell me to get my nuts chopped off and to get breast implants and to, they tell me to, don't listen to my parents, that my parents are just evil, and that, and what's interesting is something the guy says is, and these are older men, they're like in their 70s maybe, and something he says, you know, 2 years ago, I would have thought you were crazy. He's like, but today, I don't know. And so I like putting people in between a rock and a hard place or whatever you want to call it. If these guys, if they told me that I was crazy, then that means that they're leaving themselves vulnerable to be attacked by the social justice warriors of the left. Or if they play my little game, you know, if they try to play nice and they say, oh, you know, like, go to Thailand and get your nuts cut off and don't listen to your parents, then they lose again because they're being ridiculous. Like, you shouldn't be telling somebody to go get their nuts chopped off when, like, what is it, like 42% of post-op, you know, transgender people commit suicide. You know, it's not something you should be really telling people to go do. So I like putting people in these predicaments where it sheds light on the insanity of our, you know, our current situation socially.
Yeah, I definitely thought the part where they say, you know, oh, 2 years ago I would have said, you know, I would have thought otherwise, but I thought that part was very interesting because it shows just how ramped up the progressive liberal agenda has become in the past few years of the Obama administration, where, you know, everything just, you have, you know, it started off with college students and then, you know, just your average liberal. Now it's, you have like old conservative white guys who are probably really racist and patriarchal for their whole lives saying, yeah, you know, go ahead and go against what your parents want, become a transracial, gender freak, essentially. And I mean, yeah, what you said was very apt too, about the fact that if they don't go along with that, then they're going to be open to attack from social justice warriors. And you know, at the end of the day, I think a lot of these people just want to be left alone and they just want to live their lives. So the left has basically incentivized people to go along with it because the costs of speaking out against it, you know, I mean, they're varied, you know, from one just getting, you know, harassed on the internet, but, you know, you will quickly lose social capital if you don't go along with the left's laundry list of, you know, absurd demands and, you know, social justice causes. But why don't we use that to transition to talking about your experiences with Antifa? So you were at Charlottesville, correct? Why don't you kind of briefly tell us about your experiences there?
yeah, Charlottesville was a fiasco, man. We pulled up. Me, I was with Big Blaska and James Elsup and Brittany Venti and like a whole slew of other people, and we got there, and we must have had about like 100 people with us. We had like a security detail and everything. And so we get there, and the first thing we see are police in riot gear. And a lot of the guys in our group were cheering them on, like, hey, like, you know, the police are here. They're going to keep us safe. Yay. And 5 minutes later, not even going to lie, like 5 minutes after arriving there, Baked Alaska gets sprayed in the face with something. We don't know what it was. Apparently his doctors literally told him that they don't think it was mace. They don't think it was bear mace. They think it was some chemical solution. They have no idea. So 5 minutes after we get there, Baked Alaska is targeted. Nobody else in our group were maced. He was targeted and almost rendered permanently blind. And so that was 5 minutes after arriving. I personally, I've been maced before, so I didn't really take it that seriously. I kind of, you know, I was like, I felt bad for him and stuff, but I was like, hey, whatever, you know, he's kind of being a pussy, whatever. You know, I kind of went on the rest of the day just like memeing and trolling, while people were just getting their asses kicked all around me. I was present for when DeAndre Harris, I don't know if you know who that is, the black male who, him and his friends, actually, they were beating this old white man over the head with a mag light, and which sparked a big brawl in the garage there. And DeAndre Harris, I think he got like $100,000 for playing the victim card. So I was present, you know, for a lot of this stuff. A lot of it was just a battle. It was the whole day was a battle. I was even pointing. I was with a group, and I was pointing at the helicopter, explaining it, how dangerous helicopters are, like about a half hour before the helicopter crashed. But yeah, I mean, you know, in the moment, I guess I didn't feel too dangerous. I've been in these situations plenty of times. Like, I personally am comfortable, and I wasn't fighting anybody. I was filming the whole day. But I guess when you look at the footage later on, there's a lot of inconsistencies, and there's a lot of red flags in regards to the way Antifa operates. And I released a video a couple days ago that actually points out how Antifa are working in groups to immobilize and attack specific targets. Baked Alaska being one. And so we ended up finding video footage of the man who actually did attack Baked Alaska. We found that he was working in a group of at least six. And we actually found that the person coordinating that group was Spencer Sunshine, who is like a self-proclaimed leader of Antifa and social justice warrior. You can look him up. So we found all of this through, just analyzing hours and hours of footage. And, these people, they're not just, you know, some teenager wearing a mask, like gonna go out and save the world. And that, you know, these people are working together. They're being paid by these advocacy groups, these like, you know, SJW rights. Organizations, these Antifa they're trained in tactics. They're trained in military tactics. They know exactly what they're doing. They have targets. They have pre-planned targets that they're looking for and they want to hit. And, we haven't been able to identify one of the people in this group other than the coordinator, Spencer Sunshine. And so it's kind of creepy that the news, they don't talk about the fact that, this group who goes by the name Antifa are using military style tactics to take out their political opponents. And if you look at the definition of terrorism, terrorism can be defined as the use of violence or intimidation to, silence your political, religious, opponents. And so that's exactly what they're doing.
Yeah, it is quite disturbing that they are essentially allowed to run wild. We've seen that in many different cities. Many different police departments have just stood back while Antifa destroys hundreds of thousands of dollars of private property while they go around assaulting anyone who remotely looks like they could be right wing. You know, quite often these are just people out walking around town who, you know, have the misfortune of having like a closely cropped haircut, essentially. Yeah, it is quite disturbing, but I think we've seen a change recently in the way the establishment is dealing with Antifa. Because we do have to remember that political violence isn't that popular, frankly. And we saw that, it seemed to be the Patriot prayer rally. Well, I guess they do those quite often, but the one in I believe it was Berkeley pretty recently, where there was just footage of like a Mexican dad and his son getting chased down and beaten by, you know, gangs of white Antifa, essentially. So it's really bad optics. And then after that event, the Washington Post, many other mainstream publications wrote articles, you know, just with titles like Antifa attack peaceful protesters, peaceful rally goers, and so forth, which is a new development. And then we also saw, you know, some, I believe, Nancy Pelosi, some other mainstream politicians condemning Antifa, which is good, because after Charlottesville, we even had Republicans like Mitt Romney and Marco Rubio as well, who's sided with Antifa, said that they were freedom fighters, they didn't say freedom fighters, they said, you know, peaceful protesters and whatever. But the point is that I think we're starting to see a shift in the way the establishment is viewing and relating to Antifa. Have you picked up on that at all? And what possible explanations could you have for that?
Yeah, I've picked up on that. it kind of worries me a little bit that the president called Antifa the alt-left. He sort of coined that term that hadn't been used before. And now when we see these publications condemning Antifa, they're condemning the alt-left. A lot of them use that term. And we're seeing a lot of popular YouTube centrists talking about the horseshoe theory and how Antifa are the same as the alt-right or whatever. And we also hear that same rhetoric coming out of Bannon. We hear it coming out of the White House as well, that, oh, they're both bad, you know, they're both terrorists or whatever. And I think it's dangerous. I think we should be, I think we have laws for a reason. Like, if you commit a crime, you should, face the consequences. And we have time and time again seen Antifa and Black Lives Matter committing crimes almost consistently every single time they get together. But we don't see that same level of lawlessness from the right or from the alt-right. We don't see that. And so this whole horseshoe theory is bullshit. And so I think calling them the alt-left and then, you know, condemning them and maybe even considering them to be a terrorist organization, I think the umbrella term of the alt-left is dangerous. But, you know, I think it's a good thing that these publications are at least, seeing the world the way, it actually is, where these people are dangerous, they're hurting people, innocent people, and they need to be taken care of.
Yeah, and I think the white liberal contingent of the Democrat Party, which seems to be on its way out, I think they've started to realize that, if they want to get the white working class to vote Democrat again, so long as there are still white people around, they're not going to do it when Antifa are going out there and attacking people who voted Trump for trade policies or immigration policies that the Democrats would have supported, you know, a few decades ago, because they are essentially pro-worker. But the contemporary left doesn't really care about the worker at the end of the day, or if they do, it's at the bottom of their you know, it's pretty low in their hierarchy. You know, they're more concerned with microaggressions, racism. I mean, frankly, it all comes down to race, honestly. I think that is the biggest fault line, you know, as part of this fracturing that's going on in America. And as an interesting anecdote, you know, back in, you know, the 70s and so forth, with the Days of Rage, many authors have suggested that, you know, the anti-war stuff that we remember hearing from the left was, the leftist radicals actually used the anti-war stuff that was already pretty popular on college campuses. They kind of used that as a way to promote their agenda, which was essentially, you know, racial liberation. It was, or that's what they considered it, you know, revolting against quote-unquote white supremacy. So I think the fact that the contemporary left is really concerned with race more than anything else, it says a lot about, you know, what's kind of going on. You've packed all of these groups under the same state, forced integration. You've told minorities that if they're not succeeding at the same levels as whites, that they are the victims of racism. So it's really just kind of a recipe for disaster, don't you think?
Yeah, I do. Yeah, it's strange. Like, these people, they... I had a debate with some lefties the other day, and I was trying to just find stuff that we would agree on, and we agreed that we wanted to sort of at least audit the Federal Reserve, if not abolish the institution altogether. And you know, they sort of were telling me the whole time, like, oh, that's not a big deal. Like, we agree on that, but we don't agree on XYZ, you know, like race relations and stuff like that, you know. So yeah, you know, that's all they care about, really, when there's all these real issues going on above them.
Yeah, and I think that's a big part of the reason why race is the single biggest taboo in society. Well, I mean, you can obviously talk about race within a social justice context, but having any inegalitarian or white identity views on race is the biggest taboo, and I think there are, you know, many reasons for that. And I mean, first and foremost, if you look at what the ultra elite of the world want, it is essentially a more unified, you know, globalized world. And nationalism, particularly in the most relevant countries, which are white countries, you know, nationalism is kind of the biggest obstacle for them. So I think it is largely economic up at the top. I don't think that the globalists, as we call them, like, want to erase white people and, you know, diminish white population size just out of spite, although there is some degree of that somewhere. But, yeah, I mean, if you wanting to have homogeneous white Western countries that are independent, that are sovereign, that is that really goes against what the elite are pushing for. But you said something that was that reminded me of another thing that I've seen you involved with. The debate comment reminded me that Paul Joseph Watson of Prison Planet InfoWars agreed to debate you on Twitter, but I haven't seen anything come of that. So why don't you kind of talk about that for a bit?
Sure. Paul Joseph Watson, he boldly claimed on Twitter that he would debate anybody, anywhere, anytime, just in his words, not somebody with that haircut or whatever. And so I quickly seized the opportunity to challenge him to a debate. And I worded it very well. So, like, I challenged him. I said, Paul Joseph Watson, debate me on the validity of the claims of the so-called Holocaust. Something like that. And so I'm in a lot of different internet groups. Most I won't mention here, but, I've got a big team. And so I floated that tweet to a lot of people, and within about 60 seconds, the tweet had like 80 likes and like 20 responses, all egging Paul Joseph Watson on, like, we were calling him a pussy and this and that. And it was pretty late at night, and so he comes out and he accepts the challenge, which was kind of scary at first. I was like, oh crap, here we go. And the internet took it from there. There were memes and everything. And so me and Paul Joseph Watson were DMing and, you know, we were exchanging talking points really so that, you know, he could get read up on the subject. It didn't seem like he really knew much about it. And so I gave him some of my evidence and some of my talking points. And, I told him like, look, like this is a debate on the 6 million number, on the existence of gas chambers, and on whether or not there was a premeditated systemic plan of mass extermination of the Jews. And so these 3 points were the points we were going to be talking about. And, I provided evidence to my claims. And he stopped responding after I gave him all of the evidence. And I DM'd him like a couple times after that. And then he came back with me. He messaged me back and said, don't worry, I'm busy, you know? And so I gave him about a week after that. And then I messaged him again and said like, look, dude, just like, give me a good reason, you know, as to why you don't want to debate, and, you know, no big deal. But he still hasn't responded. And I've talked to a few people that are close to him. I know a lot of people, and I guess he was a little buzzed on alcohol when he accepted the debate. That's one of his excuses. And I guess he was afraid. I guess he didn't feel comfortable, you know, debating somebody on that subject. So I guess his, you know, his response was to not respond at all.
That's, that's really weak. I can't say I'm terribly surprised, though. Paul Joseph Watson, he does talk a lot. He does like throwing, you know, straw men out against the alt-right, but he never... When it comes down to engaging with, you know, our actual ideas, you see very little from him. It's always, oh, the alt-right believes Jews control everything. You know, very, very unnuanced, you know, straw men, essentially, against us. So, yeah, I mean, that does make him look very weak and very, very afraid to venture into certain topics. Obviously, it's weak, but I wouldn't have expected him to even agree to such a debate. I mean, even, because that's, for whatever reason, that subject is so incredibly taboo that even just having a conversation about it, even, you know, for the sake of a debate, questioning whether or not it happened, even defending against those allegations in certain contexts can be seen as, you know, being complicit in Holocaust denial. So it's, yeah, I'm not terribly surprised that he didn't go along with it, but right, you know, just not responding after a while and hoping it would go away. It's really embarrassing, but well, you know, he makes videos about you know, low hanging fruit, like the migrant crisis, like those, you know, intolerant SJWs, which I guess, you know, plays its role in all of this, and, you know, perhaps sends people to the alt-right, so I won't be too critical of him, but yeah, weak stuff.
Yeah, you know, I don't blame him, really. I mean, he could really, you know, that could hurt his career if, you know, he lost a debate on the Holocaust to some no-name troll named Mustache Matt. Like, that wouldn't look too good either, so... I mean, I think from a career standpoint, he made the right move, but, you know, our people really aren't going to let him live that one down.
Yeah, we definitely should continue trolling him and so forth. There's been a recurring theme among those in the alt-right. When they try to attack the alt-right, it rarely works out. I think even it's not as if all of their followers are alt-right, but... I think people on the right, Trump supporters, just, it doesn't seem cool to attack, to punch right, essentially. Just Trump supporters, they don't want to see attacks on other Trump supporters, I guess, is what I'm trying to say. And especially when people like Paul Joseph Watson are using similar talking points that, you know, you hear Rick Wilson or, you know, Rachel Maddow use about the alt-right being virgins, the alt-right being, you know, in their mom's basement. It's just really, you know, these really boilerplate responses. You know, Mike Cernovich is a perfect example. When there have been days when he's just, you know, gone off the deep end attacking the alt-right on Twitter. Later he'll go back and delete all of the tweets generally. But you read the replies to his tweets and they're just, you know, there are people that are just like, what are you doing, Mike? Like, why are you doing this? And not even like, you know, Pepe 88 saying stuff like that. It's just, you know, that random Trump supporter who's doesn't get it. But yeah, Paul Joseph Watson needs to, I don't think we should let this go. He needs to debate Millennial Matt.
Yeah, if you're listening, Paul Joseph Watson, just DM me, bro.
Yeah.
Send me a message, man.
Debate Millennial Matt, you coward. Okay, so let's kind of back to the subject of Antifa. Have you been personally harassed by them?
Yeah. So after the whole, after the whole Charlottesville thing, I was doxxed. Like, this was a coordinated attack too. Like, this wasn't like, oh, we just happened to find his information and just happened to put it on the internet. And no, like, they had my information, well beforehand. I actually found a website, an Antifa website that had all of my personal information on it, as far as, 5 months ago. So they were planning this attack, I received thousands of death threats and, through phone calls, through emails, through social media. But what the worst part about the whole thing was they put my family's information on the internet and they were attacking my family. They were sending my family death threats. And some of these threats were serious and were taken very seriously by the authorities. That's not something that I ever would have thought could have happened. Like I feel like I personally have like a good sort of moral compass, you know? And, so like I would never stoop as low, like if you and I got in an argument, you know, I would never call your mom afterwards and say, you know, screw you or whatever. That's just not something that I could have imagined anybody really doing. And so I was caught off guard with all of these threats that were being sent to my family. I don't know. I mean, I feel like it's a mistake. Like, I feel like I should have expected that, but I don't know. I never would have thought that Americans, you know, like fellow human beings, I never would have expected that these people would have stooped so low to send death threats to somebody's family who have nothing to do with, you know, what I'm doing or what I'm saying, are, you know, just as much as I was, and you know, that was really tough. They said my address, you know, they put my address all over the internet. It actually wasn't my address. That's like a family's address. It was my mother's old address, and she sold the house to some family, and so this poor family who has a young child, they were receiving all of these threats as well. They found out that their address was on the internet and stuff. So it's just, I don't know.
Yeah, the collateral damage is kind of a common thing when Antifa decides to dox someone. I've seen that happen before. They go after someone whom they think is a Nazi, or they think they have the right address, the right person, and it quite often it doesn't work out well. And yeah, what you said about Antifa going after people's families is very good to point out. I mean, the difference between, that's a huge difference between us and them. I mean, it's not only, you know, if you and I got into an argument, but I mean, if you, if there was, I mean, there are plenty of Antifa whom I'm sure you could single out who were involved in your doxing and so forth. But like, you would, even if we harassed them, which, I mean, what we do is they commit a crime and then we, you know, through poll and Twitter, we collect evidence and give it to the authorities. But, I mean, even beyond that, you would never, I would never go after, like, an Antifa member's family. I mean, I still have the sense of, you know, these people are, like, human beings and may not be complicit in the contemptible, despicable behavior that their, you know, that their kids are engaged in. But, you know,
yeah.
Antifa, these people, they'll spray paint, or not spray paint, they'll mace, you know, women, children, they'll, you know, beat up anyone who remotely looks like a Nazi, they've poisoned people's dogs, these are, you know, these are sick individuals, frankly, these are just, the political stuff is, I feel like for most of them, is just an excuse to act out like this, to just be destructive, chaotic. I mean, they're generally, you know, personally, they're train wrecks. Most of them are, have some, you know, substance abuse issues, or they're just, you know, like, objectively insane, and they need to have some kind of, some justification for why their lives are terrible. And I think that's why they all take to communism and anarchism, because it's very easy to just say, oh, you know, it's capitalism, it's the state man or whatever else. And people on the left generally, or on other parts of the right, accuse the alt-right of blaming everything on the Jews. I actually don't see that quite often. I think the alt-right has a good kind of culture of self-improvement and personal responsibility, that if we see, like, if I ever saw someone blaming their shortcomings on the Jews, like, oh, I'm working this bad job because of the Jews, or I'm overweight living with my parents because of the Jews, those people just get made fun of relentlessly. You know, maybe that happens in other, you know, pro-white circles, but I haven't seen that. Haven't seen that among us. But Matt, where do you think that we are headed as a country? Obviously, America is continuing to fracture. It's continuing to polarize politically. Do you think that there's going to be any coming together, any healing, as Donald Trump seems to think, or at least is saying? Or do you think that this process of polarization is just going to continue until one side, you know, essentially has power?
I guess, you know, I don't know. It's hard to tell. On one hand, we have people who don't pay attention to the mainstream media and sort of think for themselves. And on the other hand, we have people that do, you know, get all of their information from CNN or Fox and, you know, sort of live their life, you know, blaming everything on Russia or North Korea or whatever the hell they're blaming. So it doesn't seem like we're going to be coming together anytime soon. I don't know. I mean, the only prediction I have for this country is really economic collapse, and then we'll elect a nationalist leader.
Yeah, I think the economic collapse bit is very important. You know, a lot of people still have it too good now, despite all of the things that are going wrong in America. And in order to have, like, a serious revolution on either right or the right or the left, or even civil war, as people like to talk about, there you need to have people a little more outside of their comfort zone. You need to have a lot of unemployed young men, essentially. And at this point, we don't have that, so we'll kind of see where we end up. I think Trump stands to do a lot of economic good for America, good that, you know, people both right and left of center are going to enjoy. But, you know, the people have been talking about another economic collapse happening for quite some time. Obviously, we have issues with our monetary system and so forth. You know, another recession, another crash like we had in 2008, given the current state of affairs, the current state of civil unrest and political polarization, could prove quite disastrous and only complicate things further. But Matt, I want to talk to you about a few more things before we wrap up here. So obviously white identity is that along with revisionism, although I would say that the two are, you know, they're quite often linked, although they don't need to be. Those are, you know, white identity is a very taboo issue. It is probably the most taboo issue. Why do you think that is?
Oh man, so many reasons. It's hard to point out, you know, one main thing. I think maybe it's taboo because, you know, of the whole narrative being pushed by the left, you know, there's more white people in America and if you're a part of the majority, then you're the oppressor. And if you're a part of the minority, then you're oppressed regardless of your social status or economic status. So, I don't know. I think it's so taboo because, I mean, quite frankly, I think, populations are easier to manipulate when they don't have a strong sense of community. And I think that American nationalism has been beaten into the dirt over the last 100 years to the point where you're no longer an American. You're a Mexican American or a Chinese American or an African American, and people don't really identify with, you know, the American flag or whatever. It's controversial to even, you know, be an American nationalist or take pride in American history. And so I think it's an effort by these Marxists, by these communists, these globalists, whatever you want to call them. I think that it has been a consistent effort over at least 100 years to destroy the community and the nationalist sentiment of the Americans and the rest of the European countries in order to easier, I guess, maybe control them economically. I don't really know how to put a finger on it other than, you know, this sort of the whole taboo of being a nationalist or taking pride in your flag. I think, you know, it all derives from this sort of
globalist
mentality.
Right.
Exactly. Which, I guess all leads back to like the Frankfurt School Marxism, maybe even obviously before that as well. But
yeah, definitely. I think the left-wing policies that are pushed by elites, pushed by their henchmen, and ultimately, you know, violently enforced by their foot soldiers, which are, you know, the social justice warriors, Antifa, and so forth. These policies weaken nations. You're promoting things that are anti-family. You're promoting policies that are, you know, we know that homogeneous societies, through lots of research from sociology and, you know, political science, we know that homogeneous societies generally are without, you know, they generally have less conflict, they have higher levels of trust, and so forth. And so promoting, you know, mass immigration from, you know, very, very different cultures, cultures that perhaps don't have too much in common with the West, doing things like that, you know, all of these left-wing policies just weaken the nation state, and they will make it more susceptible to being part of this, I mean, the New World Order, for lack of a better phrase. It, you know, it's just kind of a more unified global system, which a lot of sounds great on paper to a lot of people, but, you know, these people, these lefties who like the idea of, you know, world government and, you know, one world, unified world, they're the same ones to go complain about the corporate media, about banking, about the special interest groups, the corporations, and all of that. They fail to realize that the idea of a globalized world is consolidating power into the hands of global capitalism, and so forth. So that's why, I mean, I think that some of them are just, some of these lefties are just consumed by hate for white people in Western civilization and men, so they don't really care about all of that. For them, they're looking for any chance to just lash out because they're just bitter, hateful people, honestly.
Right. And a lot of that comes from, like our middle school classroom history lessons on like Christopher Columbus and like the brainwashing that we are subjected to in the United States on like the slave trade. You know, there's so many lies that we've been told about the American slave trade. You know, like all Americans had slaves and all Americans tortured their slaves and this and that. You know, people's idea of the American slave trade as portrayed in Hollywood and middle school classrooms is so far from the truth. And I think that instills this underlined hatred, not only for like white people, but for, you know, American nationalism.
Yeah, absolutely. That's another thing that's promoted by the left that weakens the nation state is poisoning people's minds. You know, telling them that their history, that their heritage, it's all bad. It needs to be either erased or rewritten, or I guess now they're just telling us that, you know, what we thought the past was didn't actually exist. You know, if you go back to, you know, the founding fathers were all black, and, you know, you go back to Rome, everyone was, they were all black trannies or something. Obviously, that's hyperbole, but we do see the process of kind of erasing Western history, Western civilization. They've had all of these absurd, you know, BBC series where they've got you know, black people in, you know, Roman era Britain who are, you know, just it was always like this, pretty much. Matt, let's start wrapping up here. It's been a good talk. Why don't you kind of tell people where they can find more of your stuff on the internet?
Okay, well, I guess you can follow me on Twitter, millennial_Matt. Kind of a weird name. You could follow me on YouTube, just find me, under the same name. And, that's all I'm gonna give you.
All right, that sounds good. Well, Matt, thank you again for coming on the show, and I wish you the best with everything.
Thanks. Have a great day.